This is Teaching for Student Success. I'm Stephen Robineau. In this episode, I will have a conversation with Dr. Brian Dewsbury about an approach to inclusive instruction that goes beneath the mechanics of your courses. We won't talk about what your syllabus looks like, how you engage students in your learning environments, or how you assess students. Instead, we will discuss an approach to inclusive instruction that first and foremost focuses on the criticality of developing an enriched and enhanced understanding of your students. The ideas we will discuss in this episode have the power to change your relationship with your students, allowing you to develop an inclusive classroom that enriches the personal development of all of your students. In this episode, we will not discuss what your students need to learn. We won't discuss what your students need to be able to do. We will talk about issues that address the question, what do you want your students to become? I'm very excited to introduce Dr. Brian Dewsbury to Teaching for Student Success. Welcome, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Dewsbury is an associate professor in the Department of Biological Sciences at Florida International University in Miami, Florida. Dr. Dewsbury serves as the associate director of the Division for Transformative Education. Dr. Dewsbury is also the principal investigator of the Science Education and Society Research Program, which focuses on the social context of teaching and learning in a variety of education contexts. Dr. Dewsbury has published widely on issues of equity, inclusive teaching, assessment, and student success. Today, we will focus mostly on a pair of 2019 papers, the first entitled simply, Inclusive Teaching by Dewsbury and Brame in CBE Life Sciences Education. The second, authored by Brian Dewsbury, is entitled Deep Teaching, a Conceptual Model for Inclusive Approaches to Higher Education STEM Pedagogy, published in Cultural Studies in Science Education. We are going to talk a lot about the ideas of inclusive teaching and an inclusive classroom. The notion of inclusive teaching and inclusive classrooms suggests, of course, that there is something we might term exclusive teaching and the exclusive classroom. In fact, you use these terms in your papers. Perhaps you could begin by talking about these terms and your major concerns.
It's a much more philosophically deep question than maybe many listeners might even consider. The reason why I say that is because a lot of times when that question is asked, the first things people might go to are, here are the things professors do that's bad, right? Here are the things they do that make students resist wanting to stay in the classroom or stay in this particular subject. And I ask people to really perhaps take a couple steps back and think about how most professors are trained to identify themselves professionally. And as somebody who went through grad school, you know, you are raised to be a subject matter expert, which is not something I'm absconding, right? I do believe you need to have some kind of expertise, but you are raised to believe that that's the only thing or the most important thing that constitutes who you are as a faculty member, right?
Right.
It's important, I think, to have that, you know, if you have a research program, you want to keep contributing to the field, you want to discover new things, you want to write grants, papers. Mm-hmm. The problem, however, is that since that was labeled as the only thing that you needed, the other parts of your profession as a faculty member, namely teaching, namely things like advising, even things like running a lab and managing people, somehow the whole system assume you just do that on the fly. Like, because you knew everything there was to know about frogs, it meant you could walk into a classroom and teach a class about frogs.
Right.
This, quite frankly, disrespect of the skill and the scholarship of teaching, I think is what has led us to that this point where exclusive classrooms just became the status quo. So you think about something as simple as you give an exam or a quiz or something and a student gets a bad grade. The automatic thinking is that it's something that student didn't do correctly, right? There was never any culture of maybe I didn't write the questions as reliably as I thought. Maybe I didn't actually explain this as reliably as I thought. Maybe I don't understand what it means to have, you know, to motivate students to engage in this discipline. Maybe students don't see themselves in this discipline and thus aren't motivated. All these things are very well-studied constructs, but virtually none of it is included in graduate training.
Right.
So It is thus no surprise that when most people leave with a PhD and, you know, get a faculty position and, oh, by the way, here's a class for you to teach, that their sort of default behavior is centered around, you know, I'm the person coming in here with all the wiseness. I know that's not a word, but deal with it. Right. with all the wisdom, right? And therefore it's your job to kind of absorb this. And I think, I dare say, even through the kind of progression of active learning, which I support and I love and I do, but I think there was still this focus, this hyper focus on, but we must talk about this. We must cover. Mm-hmm. Without really thinking about, well, first of all, why the obsession of coverage and who was dictating, you know, this volume of coverage that was needed. But also to me, what was a little bit more obvious, you know, if you have one semester with a student or even 4 years, maybe even 6 years with a student on your campus, in any given discipline, it is mathematically impossible to tell them or to expose them to all the information in that subject area.
Sure.
Let me be clear, Steve. I am not arguing for content-free classrooms, but there's also a need to understand the socio-psychology of what it means to be in a classroom space, in a discipline, enrolled as a student, depending on how you identify, you know, different ways you are motivated, understanding that as a skill and applying those skills to your pedagogy. So it's less the original question about exclusive. It's are we actually teaching people how to teach?
Well, I think we know, and as you've said, we clearly are never teaching people how to teach, at least in the past. Rarely in the sciences, right? We, exactly as you said, we get our degrees and we move on and we move into a classroom and we just start teaching. We take it on and we do what everybody does, is we do to our students what was done to us as a student, because that's all we know, right? Because in the past, we've never been taught. I mean, the good news is that is changing in the U.S., right? There is effort to train incoming faculty to provide them with some. It's not universal, but at least we're seeing it in a number of places. So that's great. The other thing, of course, in an exclusive classroom is that there are students who are not engaged in these classrooms. In terms of student success, we have students who are failing to progress in the system. And the students that fail to progress are predominantly the historically excluded and marginalized and minoritized students, right? We know that as well. Mm-hmm. It's a critical problem. People often say, oh, we need more students in STEM. Well, we don't really need more students in STEM. We need to stop failing the students we have, right? Right. There's plenty. I mean, your classes are full. The intro classes are full. There's plenty of students coming in. The problem is there's not plenty of students going out. And the diversity of the students going out, it does not reflect the diversity of the students coming in.
That sort of ties back to the original problem, right? You know, if the lens is, if anything goes wrong in this experience, then it's because of something you did, right? It's you, not me kind of speech. Then that blinds you, whether you're an instructor, a chair, a dean, that blinds you from doing any kind of forensic analysis on your own behavior, your own curriculum design, your own classroom culture, your own campus culture. You are right that a lot of that is changing. I would say not fast enough. I would say not deeply enough. I would say we still, for me, at a point where we are trying to solve this problem on the back end by having workshops and podcasts. You know, I'm sure everybody will listen to this, but, and I think these things are great and should. No, I think these things should happen. I'm not critiquing it. I'm saying this is part of what a more comprehensive solution would be. I would start looking a bit more seriously at that pathway to faculty,
yes.
Right? And to me, if you think about it compared to other professions, it's kind of laughable, actually, right? What we do. Because if you wanted to become a doctor, right, you would be a STEM major, you would go to med school, you would do a fellowship, you know, lawyer, same thing. Like most professions, you basically understand that if this person is going to do a thing for the next 2, 3, 4 decades, It serves is in everybody's best interest that they get some real good training at a preparatory level before they actually start getting a full salary. Somehow in academia, we think it's okay to just send the frog expert with no like teacher training at all and say, you know, so some of these, you know, disaggregate statistics of, you know, students of color not getting through gateway classes as much. I mean, it's sad, but you also can't be surprised, Because when you go to the default, what happens is that your classroom just simply replicates all the inequities that exist in wider society. Because the teaching is not an intervention. It's just really just kind of passing the inequity along. So you come in underprepared, or you come in from under-resourced communities or under-resourced schools. You come in having not known a black scientist in your entire life. You come in not having known a female physicist. You know, right? If nothing is intentionally done, particularly at the gateway level, the results are out there, right? People leave not just because of poor performance, but also because they look around and like, this is not for me. This doesn't speak to my values. This isn't, you know, you have no interest in people like me becoming a scientist. And you know, when it really hit me, Steve, was when I was a grad student. Well, you know, we had a speaker series, etc., brought some scientists from around the country to talk about their life and their career. And at the end of it, we interviewed students about what the impact of the series was on them. And in that focus group, one of the things that was coming out was like, we're in a mostly Hispanic school, and most of the faculty members in this department are white. What that says to me is that people like me don't become professors. They've seen doctors who look like them. They've seen, you know, or they at least understand the appeal of those careers from a financial perspective. But representation does matter, right? And if not representation, but at least how we kind of highlight and lift the voices of the marginalized in the context of the classroom, you know, all of that matters. It's not a squishy thing. It's a reality thing and a life thing and a love thing.
I think what you said earlier really resonated with me, the notion that the things we've been doing for the last decade, 20 years, something like that, have been started to approach this in a, I'm going to say superficial. I don't really mean that, but it's like, what's going on in the classroom and how are we going to improve it? So active learning, right? So, you know, using scientific teaching, bringing the, you know, how we do science into the classroom and apply it. And people are studying it, doing education research. And we're talking about how we change classroom. But what you're proposing and where I want to go is a much deeper dive into an individual faculty's sort of psyche to look deeply at yourself, understand who you are, how you got there, and then to think about the challenges that your students have faced in their academic career or their whole career. And one more thing, of course, you also talked about the lack of training in higher ed. Of course, we don't do that in K-12, right? The K-12 teachers have training. So it's clear that higher education never valued teaching. We never valued teaching historically. That's been true, right? And that's just proven by what we do. In R1s, you hire faculty for what they do. They come in, they do their research, and that's how you are successful. And that's how the institution has set up the paradigm to succeed, right? Success is through grants. I don't want to go down that road right now. Let's come back to your stuff. Let's get back to what you now propose. Go ahead, anywhere you want to go.
Well, before we get to what I propose, and I promise you we won't go too far down that road, but I do want to make the point, which I think is what you are making, is that it is very difficult to talk about the transformation of teaching quality and how we train teachers and all of that. We can't disentangle that from the problems of the wider system. So everything you said about how teaching is incentivized, how it's rewarded, how we hire, you know, how we grant tenure, all of that stuff, that has to be put on the table at the same time we are talking about this. Because the problem is, we can talk here for 3 hours on this podcast about how we need to train professors before they come to the classroom. But if they're going to come to the classroom and it's not going to be valued on an annual review, if they come to the classroom and they're going to be valued for something else when they go up for promotion, then that training actually really doesn't matter, because the institution has communicated that in terms of your presence here, your professional identity here, this is what we care about.
Right.
And I think for too long, the conversation got stuck on, you know, it's us who need to change. It's the professors who need to change. And that's not untrue. But the professors are part of a system, whether we like it or not. You know, I would recommend the book Amateur Hour by Jonathan Zimmerman. I'm sure there might be others out there. I just haven't seen them. But it's probably one of the best books I've read that gives essentially a history of college teaching. And you will find when you read it that what you just said is exactly true. There was literally no history of it being valued. You go back decades and this idea of teaching professors to teach, there was a thing at one time they were considering people from normal schools, schools that would train teachers, to train professors. And, you know, the academic shut that down immediately. you know, even at liberal arts schools and schools where you would, that don't really have large research programs, there still is sort of debate on what is a really clear and reliable way to assess good teaching. But I would say, you know, if I want to take a glass half full approach to this, this to me is a challenge for the academy. This to me can't be something we just put our heads in the sand and say, you know, this is the way it is. It's so sad. Yeah, maybe this is partly why I do what I do, right? I see the beauty of what it could be. I don't set my class up to be so much inclusive in the sense that inclusive is a type of teaching. I set up my class to be a good teacher, and to teach is to assume that everybody in that space, no matter what they look like, what they think like, what their backgrounds are, whether I agree with them or not, that they feel included, welcome, and respected in that space. So that way, everything that I'm doing in that classroom is not designed to be a form of protest. It's designed to teach you how beautiful and magical this world could be and where you can put your own place in it. You know, when I was an undergrad at Morehouse College, you know, we got the look to the left, look to the right speech too. And I remember thinking as a 19-year-old, why would you want half your school to not be here next year? Like, what? What kind of financial model is right? It was just head-scratching stuff, right? But it is what it is. I mean, I had a great time at Morehouse and did well in some classes, struggled in some. But I will say that the classes that I remember the most, and I dare say I learned from the most, were professors who, it wasn't so much about active learning and being busy, and it was that they cared about what I had to say. They brought in problems to the class and they said, your opinion matters in solving this. Yes, we'll show you the basics of this chemical equation, or, you know, how ecosystems work, etc., etc. But here's why understanding that matters. If you were presented with this challenge, what would you do? And so you felt, you know, whether it was their intention or not, but you felt like you had agency, you had power to actually have an opinion, and, you know, not just have an opinion in that moment, but going forward, it was giving you formative experience and what it means to find your voice. There's a sense in which that kind of mentality, and this is my belief, this to me is what you should be having when you go make a purchase, when you choose a credit card, when you vote, when you turn on cable news. Like, just because somebody's standing there in a shirt and a tie and makeup on TV doesn't mean that what they're saying is right. To me, college is that place where you teach what Paulo Freire calls the critical consciousness of the world. You don't wallow in conspiracy theories all day, but at the same time, you don't just consume everything you're told just because the source likes to make itself sound credible. And I think that kind of skill set can be taught in any class. That's agnostic to discipline. And that is sort of the more kind of pure model of the classroom that I'm looking for.
Right. So your model is very discipline agnostic. The things we're going to talk about now, and let's get to them, really have nothing to do with content. It's really about self-discovery and then empathy for your students and applying. So let's talk about that. Let's describe your model and let's walk through it a little bit.
My argument is that, you know, we are asking students to go beyond the recall and the surface and the labeling of the material and really become deep learners and deep thinkers and critical, conscientious people. And in the same way, we have to approach our teaching in the same way, right? It can't just be deliver a curriculum, assign a grade, and then we move on. So the model essentially offers a path to do that. And maybe where my model might depart from some other conversations about inclusive practices is that there's a relatively intense focus on self, like understanding who you are, why you do what you do, what inspires you to teach, reflecting on the biases you might bring to the classroom, to relationships with your students in particular, and then also getting to know your students, not just on a I know your name kind of thing, but understanding where they come from, their history. You know, if your classroom is fed, say, from a particular community, understanding the history of that community, because all of these things then connect to potential, underlying potential, socio-psychological contingencies that might impact how they navigate your classroom. I'm not saying these things are definite, but I'm saying they're possible. And so if we are going to be prepared to design curricula around that, then we need to understand what they are. And this is sort of part of the scholarship that I'm making the case that should be taught prior to getting there. At the time I wrote it, I think there was a little bit of an appetite in the field for best practices. People would just ask me, hey, can you tell us what are the 5 things I should do on Monday? And while I appreciate that ultimately you do want something specific that you can do and then test and measure, and I was concerned that people were not willing. I mean, willing is harsh because I know bandwidth in faculty life is not much. There wasn't an environment that encouraged people to really take steps back and learn, almost relearn, you know, American history, the history of education, the history of how, you know, navigational capital operates between people of different identities before you start getting into, you know, how many clickers I should use, or should I do groups be 4 or 5, or, you know, that kind of stuff. And I was also trying to re-centralize some names in literature that, quite frankly, I felt was being ignored in many discussions about inclusive classrooms. Like you said earlier, from the K-12 world, where, Steve, they've been discussing this for a century. Like, this is, you know, we were sitting up here in higher ed and acting like this is groundbreaking. Like, this is not, like, I didn't say anything new in that paper, right? This has been talked about. We just need to pay a bit more attention to this part before we start getting to mechanics. The mechanics do matter. You know, if education is in effect a dialogue and a building of relationships, well, there are things that go into that you have to pay attention to. And that was the key behind that.
And it's really the building of relationships there that's key to this whole thing. You start with this section on self-awareness, right? So the first piece is really becoming aware of yourself and your background, and, as you said, your biases and motivations. Let's talk a little bit about empathy.
It's a relatively broadly construed version of empathy. I think a lot of people, when they think about empathy, they might, I could be wrong about this, but a lot of times when people, it is brought up to me in conversation, it's with an individual and their situation. I'm making the case here that there's actually a couple different levels to it. Maybe the best way I can explain this is to use my experience teaching as an example. I enjoyed 7 wonderful years at the University of Rhode Island, which is located in South Kingston, Rhode Island. A lot of my students came from Providence, Rhode Island, which is only 35 minutes away. But in terms of the degree to which people actually moved around this very small state, it might as well have been in Canada. And I remember when I got there in 2014, a lot of my students of color would tell me that when they got to URI's campus, that was the most white people they saw in one space in their entire life.
Hmm.
I'm talking about literally 35 minutes away, right?
Wow.
So once you get over the shock of that statement, given the distance, then you start asking why. If you understand how people's movements are, right? So if your neighborhood school is 4 blocks away and your neighborhood is ethnically monolithic, if there aren't resources to travel far and wide for vacation or other purposes, and your life is mostly school and then the services that are provided in that zip code, then you can see that technically for many, there's no reason to leave. And if there's no reason to leave, like what opportunities are there going to be that you will see at least visible diversity other than what you might see in your neighborhood? And then if you understand the historical impact of redlining and restrictive covenants and the building of the federal highway system, you would understand why many of these communities were and remained ethnically and income-wise monolithic. So just to pause for a second, if I don't know that history, students might come into your class and performance might be what it is. If you don't understand that history, then your lens can quickly go to, well, it's just because you didn't prepare yourself well. But if you understand that somebody coming from a particular environment, walking into your classroom, may start feeling a reduced sense of belonging, may start making calculations about who belongs in this space or not, may start looking at your body language and your speech and things in your syllabus and ways in which you call on students or the ways in which you give feedback in the class, those things might trigger fixed mindsets about who gets to do this in ways that you don't even realize because you don't understand that. So the empathy I mean in this case is the willingness to plant yourself in that history, to understand that, to do that reading. That's a macro level. Then on the micro level, what are you doing to get to know them beyond just their student ID number? And I think the micro level is important for a couple reasons. Number one, we still have a relatively dangerous habit in STEM ed research and perhaps wider society is to keep reporting things along this ridiculous census categories. I understand why that's done. I have done it myself at times, so I get it. But we have to be careful, because what happens is you start grouping people and all of their nuances into this same bin as if they're all the same. As if all your black students will navigate your class the same way. As if all your white students will navigate your class the same way. As if all your Hispanic or Native American, and don't get me started on Asian, whatever the hell that means. So in getting to know them beyond that ID number gets at some of that nuance in ways that you won't if all you're getting is that five category disaggregated spreadsheet. So I've asked them to ask reflection assignments. You know, I want to get to know who they are. You know, I use the, you know, speaking of podcasts, I use this, I believe, from NPR. I use that prompt. And, you know, they start looking in their soul and talking about being first generation, talking about coming from West Africa, talking about being multi-race, talking about being children of divorcees. I mean, what they write is so beautiful that after that point, you can't go back to seeing this as just a random class of grouping of students. It doesn't necessarily mean I have to get into a back and forth about each essay. They just shared it. That's actually enough to get the sort of empathy going, because you're now seeing things about their humanity that you can't with a class roster.
So you're seeing their humanity. I like that. Learning to care about the students and see them as individuals and recognize that everybody isn't the same. Everybody is an individual and unique. So let's talk about classroom climate. So there's three other pillars of this model: classroom climate, pedagogy, and network leverage. Let's walk through those a little bit.
The way the model is constructed, the self and empathy, so understanding yourself and developing empathy, are the key elements. Put together, they really constitute how you build relationships with the students, with whoever's in your classroom. The nature of those relationships is what determines what I do to create classroom climate, to make specific pedagogical strategic decisions, and the ways in which I leverage other parts of the campus to enhance the inclusive outcomes of the class. And the reason why it's structured that way is because even though now I've taught that class for 7 years, it's never been the same class, because they've been different students. The eCampus title is the same, but there are 155 different individuals. And so while there has been, you know, relatively significant overlap on what I've done during the semester, every semester I do look at each essay, I do look through the roster, I do look at names, I look at, you know, where they've come from, I look at all of those things, and I sort of on top of that, I getting to know them in that first week and a half, that is what drives certain decisions that are made during the classroom time. And that is not necessarily going to be the same. And that's important because I don't want people to feel like it's a sort of a plug and play thing. No matter what, here's the 15 things I'm going to do. So sometimes people would say, hey, Brian, you know, I want to stop by your class to see how it is. I was like, well, you know, we have a open door policy. So come by anytime. We leave one seat for Elijah and that's it. But just know that depending on what day you come, we could be doing one of 100 things. So climate is a very intangible thing. And I think it's something perhaps a lot of professors are uncomfortable with because it doesn't fit itself very neatly on a regression model or an Excel spreadsheet. But I am heavily influenced by colleagues in theater and the arts who have actually worked with me on being able to read a room, to look at nonverbals, to understand body language, but also orally, like, you know, the kinds of things, you know, I think you've met with Kimberly Tanner earlier in this series and talked about instructor talk, just all those little things, paying attention to all those little things that can either confirm a fixed mindset or disabuse it. So there is almost an over-intentionality of how each class is thought of. Every 10 minutes is accounted for. Like if we're discussing something in class and you anticipate an answer may not be correct, I have in my mind prepared what I'm going to say, and knowing that what I'm going to say, I'm going to say it in a way that doesn't deflate that individual. I don't want to call myself an orator, but the way in which, like, I describe things or explain things, you know, bring people in, I think there is value in working on speech and being, you know, exuding that passion about the subject matter. There's value in creating structure and rules, but still keeping it sort of relaxed and open so that people understand that there's structure to what's happening, but they feel that they're fully engaged. Like, I don't do things like penalize students for having cell phones out. Because here's the thing, Steve. I've been at talks, and I'm sure you have been too, where about 10 minutes in, all right, let me see what's up in ESPN. I think we're done. No, because, sure. So I'm not saying it's okay for them to do that. I want to actually challenge myself that during this 15 minutes, you don't want to go on your phone.
Exactly.
You actually don't want to, you don't want to do that because we've created an experience that you want to be a part of. And that's what I mean by climate, right? And so it's hard to kind of go through the 15 things in this 1 hour, right? But I just hope your listeners kind of get that, what I mean by that. It doesn't mean you have to be, you know, an entertainer. Like, it's not about that. It's not about the circus. But it's about understanding that atmosphere matters.
Right.
Right. You go to any good live play, you'll understand what that means.
That's right. When students are on their phone or they're distracted doing something else, the answer is it's because you're not providing them what they need at that moment at that time. They've disengaged. Or the other thing that happens, of course, is students have a family member that's sick and they're checking on them. I've had that happen. A student actually told me, hey, I'm going to be on my phone during class because my dad's in the hospital. And I just, so there's lots of things going on there. Yeah, that's fascinating. Your proposal is novel to me anyway, spending so much time on yourself and your empathy. We've been spending time on active learning and what you do in the classroom. We've been spending time on those, as you said, those 12 things you do in the classroom of 15 to keep students engaged. But you're adding a depth to that is really important. So I actually think deep learning is a really nice title for that. Yeah.
Yeah. Go on, Steve.
Well, you also have this nice statement about changing what we want students to be able to do or know to who do we want students to be. That made me reflect that comment. Who do we want students to be? Not what do you want them to do, not what you want them to know.
Right.
You want to talk about that?
You know, Elizabeth Mohey is a researcher at, I think, University of Michigan, and she had a paper called I Teach Students, Not Subjects. I was really moved by just the, I mean, it's a wonderful paper. It's an ethnography. It's a wonderful paper. But just even the title made me perhaps reflect in the same way you just mentioned my statement. And I think that transition from, you know, want them to know, to want them to do, to want to how you want them to be. That's the step that takes this experience away from an experience focused on developing experts, subject matter experts, to an experience that develops civically engaged individuals. And I think at the beginning of this conversation, Steve, you know, we were, you know, I mentioned about like this classroom where you shut the noise out and you try to imagine what's possible. And in the faculty development world, we use the term backward design a lot, you know, which is this idea that you have goals and learning outcomes, and then you figure out what you need to do to meet that. I would like to apply that phrase to society. In 30, 40 years from now, do you still want to be talking about gaps in STEM performance? Do you want to be talking about, you know, we need to be more inclusive? Like, so if we are, we have a problem, right? If we're still doing that 40 years from now. So then the question becomes, what's the imaginary, right? Like, if we fix this, what does the classroom look like? What do they say? What are these students doing? What are they feeling in a classroom where everyone statistically, or for the most part, has a relatively equal chance to be successful or to become this sort of better version of themselves? I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but I think you get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the reason why that phrasing is important, because a lot of time, I think at times, the intentions are noble, but these conversations get kind of focused on how do we deal with the marginalized? How do we help, you know, these poor kids or these black kids, these Hispanic kids? And I think that's limiting, maybe a little bit dangerous actually, because it perpetuates this sort of deficit thinking about them. But I'm actually thinking about the non-marginalized as well. Like, if you don't get a chance to engage difference in a classroom, I'm actually denying you a really important opportunity to understand the world from a different perspective than your own. So this idea of putting students together and engaging in these tough, critical kinds of conversations and creating belonging, I am actually not just referring to historically marginalized students. I'm saying that everybody stands to benefit from that. In saying that, I am in no way being dismissive of the need to close gaps. I'm saying that both can be achieved. That's where I think the who you want to be part comes. When I look around and I hear the kind of discourse in our political spaces, when I look at the CRT debate, when I hear people say things that is just critically obvious of what they don't know about their own history, I'm not even mad at those individuals. I'm actually sad for our education system that we haven't created the kinds of classrooms where that doesn't happen. Maybe that's the kind of battle I'm interested in, to create that classroom that does that. So, you know, 20 years from now, my students are not, may not remember that the base pairs and DNA are complementary. Right? They can Google that up on their finger in 2065, maybe by then, right? But, you know, but they'll remember that person who showed them a different America than the one they lived in. That's what they remember.
That's interesting.
And that's actually what I want the classroom to create.
So that's a super interesting idea, that the classroom itself is a, what term do I want to use here? That the classroom itself is not a rich environment. It's a, what do I want to say? It's an impoverished environment. The classrooms we have are sort of impoverished themselves because they don't see people for who they are.
Right.
And so it's not just the brown or black students that, or, you know, the marginalized students that are struggling potentially. You've got the students that are succeeding, that are succeeding, but only in a very superficial way. That's what I want to say, that the students that are succeeding in the course, you're proposing that even those students are not having an enriched environment.
Exactly.
Those students are succeeding.
Exactly.
By evidence of the grade, whatever that means.
Right.
But even those students are having a limited, very limited experience in the classroom that doesn't really empower them or help them grow in a more personal way.
Right.
And that the classroom you're talking about is a classroom that all students can grow, have significant personal growth.
It has to be. It has to be. Oh. And I think that's perfectly said. And then, so the obvious follow-up from that point, Steve, then is, well, what does that classroom look like? And what are the kinds of skills that an instructor needs to have in order to create that kind of classroom? And that, just to circle back to perhaps how we started this conversation, obviously has to go beyond, I'm a good chemist. It obviously does.
Right. Wow. Okay. That's been an enlightening moment for me. That's really interesting. It's really interesting to think about this in a much broader context than in just the disciplinary issues. And in all this, you're not saying that we don't need disciplinary expertise. We are still, we still need to move students from novice to expert along their academic path.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So I don't want people to hear the wrong thing here. I don't want them to hear, well, we're going to change the classroom. We're going to give up content. The answer is no, you're not going to give up content. You might be more thoughtful about the content,
right?
Instead of just teaching everything in the textbook, instead of like, here's Campbell, open wide and swallow.
Open real wide if it's Campbell.
I think that's fantastic. And maybe this is a good point to end this part of the talk. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that's a fascinating point that people need to think about and read. I want to include on the website a bunch of the readings we've talked about. So there's some that you've mentioned. I mentioned one that I think I want to put on the website as well, additional readings that I think would be super useful for people and informative. And also to note that the deep thinking paper and the CBE paper are sort of companion papers, really. And the CBE paper really has a pathway and lots of links and lots of websites and papers to read to help you individually take this journey. I mean, you can really do a lot of self-reflection and reading about empathy and learning from what you the resources you provide.
I enjoyed writing that with Dr. Cynthia Brame from Vanderbilt. So wonderful collaborator on that.
Well, thanks for mentioning her. I appreciate that you called her out there. I guess I'd like to end with just a few stories, although I think you've already told us some transformational stories. One I like to ask about is what was transformational, but you've already talked about some of your personal stories along the way. So I guess at this point, maybe I'll just ask, are there any other favorite stories you have about teaching or in the classroom that you'd like to, that are just personal away from this whole thing that you like, that you like to talk about?
I guess I'll tell you a story of a failure that I had, because, you know, maybe it is my feeling like whatever little skills or goodness I bring to the classroom is because of when I wasn't good at it or things I learned that wasn't correct. And I remember one semester a few years ago, this young lady, you know, kind of just looked disengaged from day one. A lot of moving parts, right? You know, at that time, we still had a textbook in the class. It was a kind of the online textbook. And so there's just a lot of logistics in getting people access codes and all of that on the LMS as well. And most people were doing it and in there, but she wasn't. And, you know, you would send the reminder emails, no response. And then I saw her in class, and, you know, again, you're looking at those nonverbals, right? The sunken eyes, the dropped shoulders and all of that stuff. And, you know, I calmly went to her and said, look, you know, can you come by and see me? You know, I just want to make sure everything's okay, right? And she would say yes, that she would come, but then she won't come. And this happened two or three times. Like, she would say yes, and then she won't come. And I would, you know, I'd try to encourage, like, you know, I'm here till after six or whatever. You know, you could come, doesn't matter, after class is done. So I think by the end of week two, you know, we get into a point now where, what, you know, you're starting to miss quizzes and things, and this could really be impactful. So URI has, I highly recommend this for your school if you don't have it, an early alert system, which was an office that basically dealt with these sort of extraordinary cases, right? And as I talk about in network leverage, it's good to have a relationship with some of these other parts of the campus network. So it's not just a kind of a really bad customer service system where you're just kind of sending people to doors with no direction and no understanding of what's going to happen there. So I was actually friends with the people who ran that office, and it took them a couple of tries, but they reached out to her. They eventually talked to her, and one of the people who worked in the office called me and said, you know, Brian, I obviously can't tell you specifically what happened, but, you know, one of the reasons she wouldn't come see you is because you kept mentioning you'd be there late.
Oh.
And she's in a situation where she's afraid to see men after a certain time.
Mm.
I really had to kind of stop and reflect on how much it literally hadn't crossed my mind.
Sure.
Like, just not even for half a second, right? I had prided myself on open door policy and being, you know, I guess my point here is, like, this is how biases work. Your lens is what it is. I'm not saying I'm a bad person. I'm not saying I'm a great person. I'm saying that my lens in life means that when I go into certain situations, especially when those decisions have to be quick, I can make decisions, you know, based on a bias I didn't even recognize that I have, right? And so when, unfortunately, situations like that arise, it behooves me to take a step back and then start thinking about how I may have done something similar in other situations that are similar to that, but also going forward, how do I make sure I account for people who don't have the privilege to be around even non-threatening looking males any time of the day, or how those things are construed, right? So just, it to me is kind of symptomatic or representative of what I love, but also I'm careful of with education.
Yeah.
They're a bunch of humans, right? They're not students, the students, yes, but they actually are humans first, right? And so understanding how that humanity plays out in this new environment, and thinking that each of them has their own unique history, some of which I don't know, means that I have to attend to my relationship with them with some real care. And that care is ultimately all what deep teaching is, and ultimately, to me, is what teaching is. The technical part, I think, is actually easy. The caring is what we have to work on a bit more.
I totally agree. So a follow-up question to that story. Once you knew that general information about that student, were you able to meet with her eventually and have a discussion?
Yes. So what happened was she met with that office for a while, and sort of through that office, I designed sort of a plan for her to get back into the course. And then, so she didn't meet with me until late in the semester, you know, I didn't try to force say, oh, no, I'm sorry, you can come meet with me now. You know, I wanted to let her kind of develop her comfort level on her own. But she would come to class, though. And she would come to class and she would engage and she would, you know, it was actually kind of fascinating. And she ended up passing. I mean, she didn't blow it out of the water, but it was a nice turnaround. And I was actually happy to know that, like, it didn't involve me. Just from the standpoint of, you know, I think true empathy is, this is not about Brian, right? It's not about you, the instructor. It's about them and them finding their success. And so that pathway to their success may not necessarily be through you, particularly when you make a mistake. So I was glad that the outcome was good for her. And we had that office that was able to kind of shepherd that process. And that's how that went.
Right. So you helped her get there. And then from there, she was able to get the resources she needed to engage in your class and succeed. A lot of mental energy there. So it's reminding me of a book called Connected Teaching by Harriet Schwartz, who will also be on this podcast on relational cultural theory. And again, all about generating relationships with your students. It's a great story. Maybe the last question, how has this journey in equity and inclusivity in the classroom and in academia impacted your interaction with the world outside of academia, right? How has that impacted you? So I guess we haven't said this, and I'm going to say this because people can't see you or on the radio. You're from the Caribbean, but of African descent, and you're Black, and you now live in the U.S. So people can't have seen that. So that plays into my question, I think, because, of course, you bring with it a very different perspective or very different life experience than many of us have had.
So you're asking how has it impacted my non-academic life?
Yeah.
It's a little hard to answer it because this is just my personality. I don't draw very thick lines between my academic and my non-academic life. From the standpoint of the Brian you know in the classroom is the Brian you'll see in the salsa club, is the Brian you'll see on the volleyball court, is the Brian you'll see running on a morning. Like, I don't kind of shape-shift into different things, right? And I particularly don't do that when I feel that's what's expected, right? But having said that, I will say that the fact that a lot of what I research and teach and talk about, give, you know, addresses about is on, you know, equity and inclusion in higher ed, it is something that I am just interested in life.
Right.
Is a conversation that I feel and find that is evolving. You know, you say that I'm from the Caribbean and I'm of African descent, and this is true. And that means that, you know, I'll tell your audience, when I got to Morehouse College, I felt like an outsider. I felt like an insider in some respect, but I didn't identify with the Black American experience. And I'll tell you a little secret. I used to actually go across town to Emory University, if you know Atlanta well, because they had a large international student population, and it felt more my speed. At least initially, it felt more my speed. I guess both in my professional life and in my non-professional life, I am looking forward to this equity and race conversation to evolve beyond these groups. I find myself shuddering a little bit every time I read the word Black or white, because I feel kind of force-fed into a category that I know, I get why I'm there, I get the boxes I check, but it's not that simple. And sometimes the, you know, space isn't being given to voices for whom it's not that simple. You know, I'm, as a father of two boys who are half Jewish and half Trinidadian, it's even less simple, right? Like, so my life is a life where it's a question to be answered in some way as we go forward. And I think as I pursue these questions professionally, I'm also kind of answering questions maybe in my own evolution as a mutt of various identities, all of which I'm proud of, right? You know, even a complaint. It's just, that's just what it is. So thanks for that.
Yeah, no, very interesting. And that answers the the earlier question I had about a seat at the table for Elijah. I wanted to know where that came from, but now I know.
now you know.
Now I know. I didn't know how many people would catch that reference. I did. The question was about the lens of equity and inclusivity that you've developed professionally, right? And how that has influenced your life. And it's interesting how our professional, what we do professionally, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you go out on the street and, or you take your kids to the park and it has an impact. You take it with you, right? It's like you said, you are who you are. And I wouldn't want anybody to be anything but that. I think we've covered all my questions. I am going to thank you, Brian, so much for your time that you spent with me today. I look forward to your future work on equity, inclusivity, and empathy, and how we're going to change things in the near future, right? I mean, this is really, these are issues, like you said, in 20 years, this needs to be different. Right. We need to not be having these conversations. And the only way to not have those conversations is to make changes now. That's, I think, the huge challenge. We didn't talk about how universities are going to do this, how that's really going to happen. I think we're going to have that conversation.
Look out for part two.
I will look out for part two. And we're going to have you back to talk about that, because we really need to talk about how universities refocus and dedicate themselves to undergraduate student success so that we can be in a different place in 10 and 20 years. It's not planning for 2040 isn't enough if we don't do something now to get there. Yeah, this has been a great conversation, Brian. Really, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
For more information about Brian Dewsbury, his research and recommended readings, please go to our website, teachingforstudentsuccess.org. On this website, we will post information about a number of resources mentioned during the podcast, including links to Amateur Hour by Jonathan Zimmerman, The Some of Us by McGee, links to the NPR This, I Believe prompt, references for Backward Design, and a link to a paper by Elizabeth Mohan entitled I Teach Students, Not Subjects. Thank you for spending time with us today. I hope you have found this discussion interesting and helpful. Please share our podcast and website with your friends. We are very interested in increasing our listenership. Please spread the word. Those of us at Teaching for Student Success would love your feedback. Please contact us through our website at teachingforstudentsuccess.org. Teaching for Student Success is a production of Teaching for Student Success Media, an educational nonprofit organization. Let's end this podcast with some music by Julius H. Some of Julius's music can be found on Pixabay.